Carol Walton to come up and read to us a thing that's been put together about the Auburn Fellowship. And Carol's going to come up at this time and read this for us.
I'm Carol, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carol.
This was written about the original starting of this fellowship. I think there were about 30 of us, and Jack and I are the only charter members here tonight, and somehow I got elected to read this. I don't know how that happened. In 1975, there were three meeting places in Auburn. The Saturday night meeting at Sierra Council on Alcoholism was in a small building on the corner of Palm Center. I think there's been a bar and a laundromat and a parts store in there since. Sunday night meeting in the basement of St. Joseph Catholic Church, and the old Dry Diggins meeting on Thursday night in the meeting hall at St. Luke's. At this time in the Auburn area, there were about 30 plus regular members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't have much in our collection basket, so one day several of us got together. We were standing out in the parking lot in front of Sierra Council, decided that we wanted to have a meeting where we could have a place of our own. We talked about starting an Alano Club. So we set up a meeting that was in Loomis at Carl B's place at 7 p.m. At the first meeting, Dale J. was there, Carl B., Andy A., Donna B., Lee B., Lou S., and Little Cho. And I was there also, although my name didn't get on the list. When Mike asked me to read this, I wanted to know what kind of a list he had my name on. I wasn't too sure whether I wanted to read it or not. A lady had told Lee and Donna that a friend of hers scouted around and found a portion of a building on Canal Street owned by Gary Tanko that we could rent for $250 or $300, first and last month's rent in advance. We all donated. It says here $25 to $100, but seems to me like it was a little more than that. I don't remember correctly. Anyway, we ended up with about $400. There wasn't any furniture in the place, and I don't know. I haven't been to a meeting at the fellowship lately, but the last meeting I went to at the fellowship, you were still using some of the original old tables that we built with plywood and some old school desks. The legs were fixed on some way. Anyway, we went out and rented that, and it was two great big rooms. That was in November of 1975. We needed money, which we were worried about, and so we rented the space as an Alano Club so that we could charge members dues every month so we could make the rent. Says here, oh, the devious minds of we alcoholics who will find a way to go to any lengths to get a place to meet and share. The charter members were assessed $25 a month. And, of course, we brought in new members, too. We started a volunteer sheet for members to cover a two-hour shift each from 10 until 8 p.m. AA members kept the building open for newcomers, flippers, 12-step calls, and we answered the phone part-time also. Dinners, coffee, or whatever was needed. As long as we were there, and even in the next place we moved to, volunteers put in a kitchen, added a bathroom, changed wiring, cooked dinner, swept, mopped floors, and mostly did what Alcis had been doing since 1935. We stayed sober, we grew, we hurt, and we had fun. We went to any lengths, and a lot of us are still here. Of the 7 people who met that night, 1 went back out, 1 transferred to Nevada, 1 is in Loomis, 2 in Roseville, 1 in Sacramento, and 1 is still in Auburn. Not bad. 6 out of 7 still sober and growing after all these years. AA does work, if we let it. Of the initial charter members that worked so hard making this work, only a few went back out. Some moved, some died, but about 10 of us are still around. The Auburn Fellowship finally had to leave that location due to the lack of adequate parking. So Mama Lou's daughter found us a small house on Center Street, which we rented and volunteers modified for our purposes. We stayed there for a few years and finally had the chance to move to a much larger facility, a vacant church across the street from our location, but still on Center Street. After a year, the freeway plans were finalized. The widening would wipe out our location, and the neighbors were objecting to our occupancy. I'm sure some of you know what that is. Once again, one of the members found us a space on team tracks right alongside the railroad tracks. Members again modified and painted, installed kitchens, and fixed the bath area, so we had 2 bathrooms. AA stayed on team track for several years, but again, parking became a problem and the owner wanted us out. After much searching and negotiating, the fellowship relocated to the DeWitt Center. We were there several years and once again had to move. Each time we've been faced with moving, the fellowship has grown in members and in strength. We moved into the old Auburn City Council chambers October 1992. And though the space is small, we will undoubtedly have full usage and one day move again. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. And that's a lie. I didn't come up on Air Force One. You know, the longer I'm here, the more I realize that this is an attitude adjustment in my life and how I look at things. And I'm reminded of the story of the practicing alcoholic who stood in front of his wife and he said, "You know, honey, I'm my own worst enemy." And she said, "Not while I'm alive." And and the deal is that as I get a chance to get out and about and visit with folks and stay active in my own group and get to a lot of meetings, it seems as though lives are determined as to what's said in these rooms to a large degree by people who supposedly have numbers of years. And it's a very interesting thing because the folks who always had what I wanted were the folks who were connected with Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were focused on their recovery. And they were focused on growing spiritually. And they were focused on laughing and having a good time. And one of the great things that I was lucky enough to have access to early on were guys who knew how to keep it simple. You know, they didn't have me running off doing 10 other things. In fact, I was thinking today, I was talking to a buddy of mine who still lives in New York. And he used to do some hits once in a while. And he said he feels like taking an ad in the paper and saying, you know, bothered by an inner child, give us a call. For $100, we'll take that brat for a walk and you'll never see him again, you know? Done deal, you know? Sorry, he won't be home. But it's real important for me for my own sobriety, to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it was like was very similar to being picked up by Charlie today. Charlie was frustrated as a race driver, and he picked me up in a car that was somewhat smaller than a Hyundai. And we got out on some major road and just literally chased people to the sidelines. And I said, Charlie, who are we mad at? Do you ever go buy bumper stickers so fast you can't read them? But I thank him very much for picking me up, and he took me over to his house where I had some chicken, which was good. And Irene, who read tonight, his wife, he must have asked her 10 times, honey, should I make more chicken? Honey, should I make more chicken? Honey, should I make more chicken? And I thought, either he doesn't hear when she says yes, or something happened to him. I don't know which. But it's not. I'm glad he's here, and I'm glad I'm here. And I thank him very much for staying in touch with me and getting me up here. Somebody made mention of the Al-Anons, and you know, that's real important to have an Al-Anon in your life. Because they do a lot of good. You heard about the Al-Anon who was married to an alcoholic who couldn't get sober. And finally he dies. And she calls the paper to put the obituary in. And she says, I want to put an obituary in. And the guy says, it's $5 a word. So she said, okay, put in Joe's dead. And the guy said, I'm sorry, miss, we have a 5-word minimum. So she thought for a moment. She said, okay, put in Joe's dead, Volvo for sale. So, And you see, what you guys are doing now is one of the things that keeps me active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to hear people laugh, and I love to be a part of laughter. I don't do real good with people who are continuously looking for, you know, something else to focus on and to constantly have themselves under examination. This book that I'm glad Mike didn't pass around, this book has a chapter in the back, actually not a chapter, but it has a medical viewpoint. And there's a deal in there by Dr. Bauer, which is very important to read. A lot of people don't read that stuff. And he says, the alcoholic, if he attends meetings and works with other alcoholics on a daily basis, will overcome his excessive concentration on himself. And you know, the folks who seem to have the most problems here, through my observation and experiences, are those folks who constantly hold themselves under a microscope, who are constantly trying to figure out what's wrong with them, who are constantly trying to figure out what's wrong with everybody else, who if they're having a good day say, you know, I'm doing something wrong, you know? And they make up new words like denial. You know, if you find denial in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll take you to lunch at Wendy's or some nice place. And, you know, it's not mentioned in here. And the reason it's not mentioned is because we talk about recovery. And recovery looks like denial to a lot of people. They can't tell the difference, you know. You're happy, joyous, and free. You must be in denial. Yeah. And the deal is, no, I'm in recovery. See, I'm supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. We spend pages in this book talking about that. And it's real important for me to live my life that way. I wouldn't want what you guys had if what you had was constant, constant fear, constant, constant worry, constant sadness and seriousness about stuff. You know, I get up in the morning and say, well, it's another day. Let's get out there and find a problem, you know. I wouldn't want to be around people like that, you know. I spent my whole life with people who were always looking, you know. I'm from Brooklyn. And you never ask anybody from Brooklyn what they do for a living. Never. At least not in my area. Because everybody did the same thing. They moved money. You know? And sometimes yours, sometimes his, but they were always moving money. And you ask guys in my neighborhood where I was growing up, what do you do for a living? What do you need done? You know, like, you tell me it does, you know. And I can see real clear that as I have been here, it's all about attitude. And the deal is that folks who have problems have bad attitudes. In fact, if you can stand back from it far enough, you'll see that your attitude determines the problems you have. How you treat a problem depends on the attitude you have about it. And there's never been a case in recorded history where anyone has hurt their eyes by looking at something positively. You know, there just hasn't been. You know, so the deal is that when you see something that appears to be a problem, the things that I have to remind myself of first is that really, this is a problem because I say it is. And number two is, the power that I bring there in my attitude is always much stronger than the problem itself. And the other thing which I know about it just factually from experience is, my attitude gets to the problem before my action. In fact, my actions are determined by my attitude. So if I have a good attitude about it, I'll look at it differently. You know, it's like the story where General Haig was smoking a Havana cigar at a White House party during the Reagan years. And somebody went up to him and said, you of all people to be smoking a Havana cigar, you know, you're so too far to the right and you're so conservative and you're so anti-Castro, and here you're smoking cigars that support his government. And he said, that's the way you see it. The way I see it is, I'm burning his crops down. You know? And so it's not what's going on, it's what you perceive to be going on. You know, it's never about what's going on. Most of the time, people don't realize what's going on. And then they say things, I hear people say in rooms, well, there's us in here, and then there's the normal people and the normies. Watch my lips. Remember when the other guy used to say that? Watch my lips. Watch my lips. All right. There are no normal people. There are only people who haven't shared with you. And as soon as they share, you say, my God, I thought they were normal. You know, like that. I see what normal people all do all the time. I flew up here on Southwest Airlines. There's a thing that sits in the exit row seat there. This is what normal people do. And this thing says, because you have to have the physical ability to open the door now in case there's an accident, which is always exciting when they tell you that. But the deal is that you're sitting there and there's a thing you have to read. And what it says is, if you do not understand spoken English and you cannot read this card, contact the stewardess. I mean, maybe it's me. I figure one of our guys got a job, you know. A month ago, I was in Oklahoma. Oklahoma has two airports. Those two airports are the Will Rogers Airport and the Wally Post Airport. They both died in plane crashes. You know? All they need is the Amelia Earhart School of Engineering or something. You know, this is what normal people are out there doing. You know, they do these kinds of things. And I get a chance to watch it all the time. This is a normal person doing this. You know, this is what we say is normalcy. Well, fortunately, what I have found out is that, as I said, there are no normal people. And the other thing, which was a big discovery for me, which came as a result of staying here and growing spiritually, is the fact that there is also very little logic in the world. And if I try to figure things out logically, I'm going to be very discontent and very unhappy most of the time, because there is no logic. I mean, if this was a logical world, men would ride side saddles. And we don't. You know, like, we just don't. We just don't. And the deal is that what you come to find out, and what I have found out is reading this little basic textbook here, which to me is the owner's manual, an Alcoholics Anonymous. It says it's a basic text. And being a basic text, if I were a student And I was never much of a student. You know, I got through school totally unscarred by education. And I was 4 years sober before I realized that Moby Dick wasn't a venereal disease. So, and fortunately, you don't need a lot of education to get sober and stay sober. There's a lot of people I know that, you know, that we're not the brightest bulbs in the room. And yet we're able to stay sober because we don't read into this book what isn't there. I mean, I hang out with guys, you know, they try to fax letter bombs. You know, they're just that way. But, you know, they're not real bright. I took a guy to pick up some bowling trophies a while back, and we walked in, he looked around, he said, "Wow, is this guy good, Ken?" He makes these, Phil. Oh, yeah, gotcha. The other night, we're going up to L.A. to a meeting, and the sign says, "Rest area, 25 miles," and the guy in the back suit said, "Boy, these guys really need a lot of room to relax, don't they?" So they're the kind of guys I hang out with. You know, we're not your basic rocket scientists. We're a little bit to the tapioca pudding side. You know, it's like, and the nice part about it is those guys don't read stuff in here that isn't here. In fact, they have trouble reading what is there. You know, and they stick right to it. And then I watch other folks come in and they're reading stuff that isn't in here. And to me, you know, I was listening tonight while I believe it was Debbie who read How It Works. And when she was finished reading, she said the ABCs, which when I arrived here was the message of freedom. You know, that was the message of freedom for me. It said that I'm an alcoholic, that I'm an alcoholic, and it says that I can't manage my own life. And then it says, B, that probably no human power could have relieved this alcoholism. And then C, it says God could and would if he was sought. And to me, I have had no trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous since I arrived here in that sense, because it was a very specific line to me. It said, I suffer from a spiritual malady, and when that spiritual malady is overcome, I'll straighten out mentally and physically. So there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. So I came to the realization early on that this is all about nothing more, nothing less than me getting on the path and being of maximum service to my fellow man and getting into an appreciation and an open-mindedness about God as I can understand it and allowing every other person to do the same thing. And it's not all that complicated. You know, it's an amazing thing. As I said, I hang out with guys in our group. You say, how long are you sober? We go, you know, so, you know, and these guys are happy, joyous, and free. You know, they're not running around trying to figure out what's going on. You know, they're not going to sex without partners and, you know, all this other stuff. You know? You haven't heard about them. I've been told some of their meetings get out of hand, but I'm not going to get into it. And one of the other things that became very important to me here is that I found out that what was insignificant or had no significance when it happened, if I stayed here long enough, that event would have significance in my life. I got sober back on the East Coast. And we used to always meet in a diner before we went to the meetings. And we'd meet at this diner about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and then our meetings ran from 9 to 10 o'clock. And then you'd go to the diner and you have to have something real greasy. It was required. And then you would go to the meeting with all these guys who nobody knew anything, but they were sober. And then you would have the meeting, and then you'd go back to the diner to decipher what was said at the meeting. And of course, your version of it was always incorrect because the old timers told you what you missed. And then they take you home. And the bottom line was, I remember this one night, this guy said to me, I'm going to take you down this different street. And we went down this different street. And at the time, it didn't mean a whole lot to me. And we stopped in front of this house. And it was Bill and Lois's house on Clinton Street. And it was this brownstone. And he said, see that brownstone? He said, that's where Alcoholics Anonymous started in New York. And that's where our co-founder, Bill and Lois, lived. And he went through about 5 minutes of what was real important stuff. And my response to that at the time was, are we going to have time for the diner? I'm really hungry. You know, like, I don't want to spend a lot of time looking at a brownstone. You know, it's cute. It's nice. There's a whole block of them, the whole city of them. You know? And so we went on to the meeting. And that was around August of 1970. And then just a few months later, in 71, Bill passed away. And that house became very significant to me. As I stayed here longer, the significance of what went on there and how this thing got started, just like was read tonight by Carol, was real important. It's like, this is our origin. This is where we came from. We came from very simple roots, and we came from one alcoholic carrying the message to another alcoholic. It wasn't real complicated. And the message was always the same. You come with us. We have something that has worked in our lives, and we'll show you how it works. And whether or not you want it or not is up to you, but we'll show you how it works. I kind of liken it to that old program that was on TV, Kung Fu. Remember that? Kung Fu? I used to like that kind of talk when I was drinking. You know, like, why are you rushing, grasshopper? You are already here. I like that kind of stuff. It was my kind of talk when I was blitzed. You know? And I always remember the one scene in there when the Caribbean guy had to become a priest. And to become a priest, he had to pick up this thing that was very, very hot. And he had to move it from point A to point B. And by picking it up, he would get this tattoo on each arm of a dragon. And then he'd be a priest. And when it came time to do that, he had some hesitation and some trepidation. He didn't know if he wanted to do it. He kind of looked. And when he came to the other priests, not one of them said a word. They just showed their arms. It's like, if you want, well, we have. You know? There wasn't a whole lot of ceremony. Get in there, grasshopper. This is the deal, Lucille. You know, like, you go and you do this. And he went in and he did it. And you know, that's what it is in AA. People come and they have all these unbelievable ideas about who they are. And what AA has done for me and countless others is slowed us down, removed us from drink by telling us that's very important, not to drink, and then getting on with the greatest power in the world, which is the power of love. And through the process of love, each one of us is led gently back to ourselves. And we get to know ourselves for the first time. And we get to know ourselves in a very peaceful way. And we get to know that, hey, no matter what I think I am, who I really am is so much more important. And that's where I should be spending my time. Not advancing the image of who I think I should be, but really being who I should be. And that's what these steps are. They're steps to freedom. And I'll tell you something. The book talks about being happy, joyous, and free. Freedom is always taken. It's never given. You have to go and take freedom. And the way you take it in Alcoholics Anonymous is by going through the steps. And as you go through each step, you get led to a new level of freedom about life. And you get to understand that, hey, everything is okay. It's not about it may be okay. It is okay. And you get to hear and listen differently. Most people are answering questions they don't even know the question. You know, it's like the guy who was down in Mississippi and he had never been to Pascagoula. Did you ever see Pascagoula written? It's very deceptive. So this guy from New York, he had never been to Pascagoula. So he went in to get a cup of coffee. And he said to the little lady, he says, can you help me out? And she said, how? And he said, can you tell me how to pronounce the name of this thing? I've never been here before. And she said, well, it's not that technical. He says, please, just help me out. He said, say it slowly. Once I hear it, I'll remember it. She said, okay. Burger King, you know? And it's like, and that's the way we go through life. We're asking one question, they're hearing another one, you know? And people aren't answering the questions we're asking. And we go away thinking the name of this place is Burger King, you know? And what it is it's just about paying attention. And newcomers have a tough time with attention because they're like that all the time, you know? You know, they're trying to figure it all out. They're trying to get it all in. And the deal is that what you're telling me is just calm down. You know, this, as was read tonight, this is going to take a while, like the rest of your life, you know? So just pace yourself. There's, I have a guy who just likes to run all the time. He has no sense of purpose or direction, but he likes to do it in a hurry. And he just celebrated 10 years, and I gave him a card, and he came over after the meeting, and he said, "Ken, this card really has me concerned." I said, "Why?" He said, "Look what you wrote." Because I had written on there, "Slow down. There's no place to go. There's no time limit to get there. There's absolutely nothing to be accomplished. You're going in the right direction." And he said, "I don't understand this." I said, "Good, keep coming back till you do." "I don't know what it means, I just wrote it down, you know, but help me look for another year anyway, you know. Like, next year I'll write something else confusing. He'll be back another year, you know." And it's not about giving answers to people, it's about being there and just saying, you know, if you want what we have, this is the way we go. And it's a very, very good process. And you learn to listen to people differently. And there's three types of prayer that goes on in AA. In the beginning, and the book is real definitive about this, the book says, you know, this, you go into a bookstore today and there's just shelves and shelves and shelves of books on alcoholism. I love it. And our book is real specific because it says, when the alcoholic drinks, something happens. Let me read this again, you know. So, Ken, if I'm an alcoholic and I drink, what will happen? Something. What will it be? You come to the meetings, you'll hear, you know. And then when people get sober, they say the same thing. You hear people share the same story. They're going along and they'll say, "I was at this meeting, this happened." They'll always say, "And then something happened." And so we get here by something happening called alcoholism. And we stay here by something happening called a spiritual experience that when it happens, most of us don't even know. We don't even know that somehow God intervened in our lives and we got here. And the three prayers, as I started to say, that usually bring this about, the first prayer, which is the most genuine prayer of the alcoholic, is, "God, get me out of this." That's the first surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous for most people. "God, get me out of this." And it's a typical alcoholic prayer. You know, you want something for nothing. It's a selfish, self-centered prayer. You know, "God, get me out of this. Come on." You know? And then there's a second prayer. You say after you hear a while. We dress up selfishness and self-centeredness because now we're getting more deceptive. And we say, "God, grant me the serenity, courage, and wisdom. You know, just grant me. I don't have to do anything for it. Just grant it to me." And if you're fortunate and you stay here long enough, you'll say the prayer that's the real prayer of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's, "God, use me. Use me up. Let me see your will, and then use me in your area. Use me until I have nothing left. Don't leave me anything, because I am selfish and self-centered, and if you leave me anything to work with, I'll probably use it destructively. So take everything I have. Don't leave me anything." And that's a prayer that takes a while to get to. And if you're here, you'll come to the realization for yourself when you reach that level, because someday you'll find that you have this inward peace that wasn't there before. You'll be doing something and you'll say, you hear people say, "Well, you know, I did this yesterday and it really threw me a curve. And now I find myself doing it today and I seem to be okay in doing it." And that's that spiritual growth. And that's what this is about. And you get so, you know, you get so you listen differently, you act towards things differently, and you realize it isn't about making things happen so much as allowing things to happen. And you realize that everything's happening in its own way. True acceptance for me was when I realized that every person was doing, regardless of what I thought, they were doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing, exactly the way they were supposed to be doing it, in the exact place they were supposed to be doing it. And it took me a long time to realize that. And I had to listen very carefully because I was not a good listener. I would hear what I wanted to hear, and then I'd make up the rest. You know, it'd be that kind of a deal. Kind of like the guy who went and got a physical at the doctor's office. He got his annual physical. And the doctor looked at the reports that came in. He said, you know, you're an 85-year-old man, and yet you have the body of a 50-year-old man. And you look like you have the body of a 50-year-old man. And the guy said, wow, this is exciting. So he said, here's your bill. Go pay the nurse. So he went out to the nurse, and he said, how old do you think I am? And she said, well, looking at this report and looking at you, I'd say about 50. He said, I'm 85 years old. And she said, well, you certainly don't look it. So then he was walking out of the office after paying the bill, and there was an 85-year-old woman there. He must have been a little alcoholic. Couldn't leave well enough alone. So he stopped in front of this 85-year-old woman. He said, excuse me, ma'am. He said, how old do you think I am? She said, come here. So he went over. She pulled down the zipper of his pants. She put her hand in. She fondled him for about 5 minutes, pulled it out, and said, you're 85 years old. And he looked at her and he said, how could you possibly know that? She said, I heard you tell the nurse. So the reality here is to stay focused on listening to what's going on around you, because you just never know when that information may come into play. You know, you have absolutely no idea. Everything that happens plays a role in something else that happens. And one of the things that I have found out today, and the book talks about this also very clearly, is the fact that this is not about living in absence. This is about living in presence. And the book says it very clearly to me. It says, as you become conscious of his presence, you will lose your fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. You'll be reborn. And as I have felt the presence of God in my life, I was reborn. And when you're reborn in Alcoholics Anonymous, love becomes your native language. And you just start speaking love, and you start feeling love. And a lot of the stuff that used to be there that kept you separated from people just melts away. And what you come to realize is that each day in and of itself is so very important, I don't want to waste it. I don't want to let days slip by. I want to stay focused on this day and live it to the max and laugh a lot, even if the joke's on me. You know, I'm firmly convinced in my life today that life is a joke and that I'm the punchline. And you guys are too. And if I miss out on that joke, I miss out on life. If I'm so busy trying to understand it, life is too important. It's not connected to thinking. You know? There's no chapter in here into thinking. If it was important, Bill and the boys would have put it in there. It's into action. You go and you do. You know? You can know all the theory of water. You can even know the components of water. You can know its chemical makeup. But if you're thirsty and you don't take a glass of water, all that knowledge doesn't do anything. In my brewery, your guys say, I'm thirsty, they go get a glass of water. They don't think about it. We have a little slogan in our group that says, leap before you look. By the time you did all this thought process, you could have tried it 10 times. Do you ever have somebody say, well, I know I should change. I've been talking about change at every meeting, you know. I inventory change. Call my sponsor. Went over his house, had some coffee. But when are you going to do it? Well, I don't want to rush into it, because then I'll have to go on to something else. You know? And it's all about into thinking. It's not about into action. And it's not just any kind of action. This book talks about a very definitive kind of action. And the kind of action it talks about is self-sacrificing, selfless, and constructive. Not destructive, constructive. You know, if you could just wash cups and make coffee, you could do that down at the Denny's and stay sober. You wouldn't have to come to AA. But you start making coffee in AA for somebody else. And you start cleaning up for somebody else. And you start making commitments that involve other people's welfare first. And before you know it, you find yourself doing things that were totally foreign to you before. That's what a 12-step call is. A 12-step call is an act of love that one alcoholic does for another alcoholic, initially thinking it's selfish because I'm going to get something out of it, I'm going to stay sober. And then as the book says, if you do enough of those, the joy you receive will transcend the benefit that's promised. Transcend. It will go beyond. You'll just start doing this stuff because you just feel good doing it. And I don't know about how many people in the room have gotten to see their sponsor do a 12-step call, but I've seen my sponsor do a 12-step call more than once. And a lot of folks today have not had that advantage. But you know, in my area, we didn't call them 12-step calls. I lived in Brooklyn. What they used to say is, go put the hit on this guy. You know? I lived in an Italian neighborhood. Everybody who had money was called Don, respectively. And they used to say cute little things to us as kids. Remember, money talks, but cash screams, you know? And they used to say, you know, if he fell asleep in the trunk of your car, he deserved to be shot. You know, that kind of stuff. We used to have all these cute things at tax time, like, what H&R Block won't boost, cement block will. You know, so it was like, said to a guy, what do you do when you get audited by the IRS? He said, just sit across the table and just say three words. How's your family? So it was a different, it was an entirely different mindset than other kids were being told. And so we grew up with a different mindset, and what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me and what it did for everybody else who I knew came in from the same neighborhood was what it simply just said were, those were old ideas. And you had to get rid of those old ideas. And I had to get rid of them. And in getting rid of them, I found out a lot of things that the book talked about that began to work in my life. It talks about, as I said, not destructive action, but constructive action. Even in the 11th step, where it says at the end of the day, before we go to bed, we sit down and review the day constructively. It's not a destructive thing. It's a build-up thing. The idea is to see where I made some mistakes so the next day I can try not to make them. It's not about tearing me apart. It's not about so unraveling me there's nothing left to put back together. It's about constructively doing it. And so I had to learn all of these steps as I went along. And it was a very tough process for me because I had a lot of old ideas, some of which I thought really worked. And I had to let go of those old ideas. And I had to let go of, in quotes, figuring things out in logic. Dealing with women, I went through a divorce in 81. And I started dating in AA, which is interesting. You know? It's like catching hand grenades in bunkers. You know? Because women have a language all their own, you know? There should be a convention of men held once a year where we talk about what they want. You know? Women want what they want when they want it. Where they want it. The way they want it. And you say, what is that? You love me, you knew. And they have a, you know, vocabulary all their own. You know, it takes a while to catch on to that stuff. And I don't know about you guys, but when I grew up, they played a kind of music that was very, very permanent. Songs like Till the End of Time, I'll Be Loving You Always. In 82 and 83, when I started dating, they were playing songs like Whip It, Beat It, Choke It, Kill It. You know, I was like, whoa. You know? I wasn't too sure I wanted to go out there and find out what they were talking about, you know? And the deal was is that it was something else that I learned to do. And I learned to do life in sobriety. And I learned to do life on a daily basis. And now when I get up in the morning, I do life very simply. I ask God in the morning to direct my steps during the course of the day so that I might see and do His will, and that I may not get confused with my own selfishness and self-centeredness. And then I get on with the day, and I live the day. Anything I'm supposed to know will come to me in the course of living the day. If I'm not meant to know it, there's no sense knocking myself out. If it's important enough, it will become known to me. And life gets real simple that way. It's not about continually trying to figure out what's going on. I'm not at war with anyone. And that's why I love this book. Because as I went through this book, what I could see in here was that there was never one sentence in here that was antagonistic to me as a human being. It simply said, this is what we did. If you think you want to try it another way, go try it. even if you're not too sure whether you're an alcoholic. What does it say? If you don't think you're an alcoholic, step next door. Get your own experience. Don't buy into someone else's experience. Go get your experience. Try it more than once. Who knows? You may be a winner. Yeah. Oh, you can't do it either, huh? Okay. But that's what I loved about this. It was always about going and getting my own experience and not trying to rest on what someone else said. I could listen to you folks share your experience, but maybe it wasn't my experience. And in reading this textbook, I came to find out what is Alcoholics Anonymous and what is a lot of opinion. Well-meaning folks, they're not harmful unto themselves, but well-meaning folks oftentimes make up stuff about Alcoholics Anonymous that has absolutely nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, down in our area, they talk about no sex in the first year. You find that in here, I'll take you to Wendy's too. You know? You keep the average alcoholic away from sex for a year, by the time he gets back to it, he'll forget who gets tied up. You know, he just just won't know what's going on. And fortunately, that's not what this book says. It never mentions anything like that. It just says, let God be the final judge of what you should do in that area. And that's what I liked about this. It always came down to me and God. And it had nothing to do with anyone else. And really what it said was to go to the meetings, be a maximum service to other people, and to allow myself to grow spiritually. Now, when I got here, like most people, I was not on a winning spree. You know, I didn't walk into Alcoholics Anonymous because suddenly my life was perfect and I wanted to add something on. You know, I'll go put the embroidery of alcoholism on my life, you know. I got here because, like most people, I could not live sanely. And I didn't know what that meant either. I lived insanely. My dad died when I was young. My mom had 7 kids. I was the youngest. And it meant somehow that I had to go and do something to make money. So I started running numbers. And that's something I could do, and it generated cash. And I was 13 or 14 years old. And to show you how this program works, which is kind of scary in a way, is that I started carrying a gun. And I would carry that gun tucked in the back of my pants. And the end result of that was, on several occasions, I had to use that gun in business situations. And it wasn't something that's what my mom and dad raised me to do. It wasn't something that they said, this is what we want you to be when you grow up. And the end result of that was, 3 years ago, I was speaking in San Diego at the San Diego Roundup, and I was the spiritual speaker Sunday morning. And right before the meeting started, before they started reading How It Works, they brought a fella up, and he's 5 years older than me. And the last time I had seen him was 35 years ago. And when I saw him, he was trying to take away the money I had. And I had pulled his gun and put it in his face. And as was said by somebody in AA over a long period of time, this is a game of seconds and inches. And fortunately, he backed away. And here he was, 67 days sober at an AA meeting. And he came up and he said, Ken, do you remember me? And unfortunately, I did. You know? And he said, this thing may work after all. He said, I'm 67 days sober, and you of all people are the spiritual speaker. You know, like And so the guy who introduced me always introduced me by telling people how much I made him laugh, and when I got up, I couldn't laugh. In fact, what happened to me was I stood there for a few minutes, and these tears of joy just came out of me, because I realized that in my life, on several occasions, something could have happened a different way, and my life would have been changed forever. And it had to do with not doing something I wanted to do, but doing something I thought had to be done. And I was just wrong. It's amazing how wrong I was in actions I took, but I didn't know it until I had time to come here and put it in some kind of perspective. And I like the part about spiritual growth, because that's something I can do all the time. And that, to me, is what this program is. It's nothing more than growing spiritually. And as I grow spiritually, most of the stuff that used to bother me just kind of slips away. And it slips away because I realize that almost everything that people do to me, I have that capability to do to them. And maybe more so. And so the end result of that is you just become more and more relaxed in life. I like, you know, at one time in my life, I was in a state institution for 4 years. And I had some time. And I used to read. And one of the books that I remember reading was talking about Newton, this guy Newton. And Newton found out that things, when they fell, fell down. And he was the guy who discovered gravity. He didn't invent it, he just discovered it. He said, you know, when things fall, they fall down. And then he went on to talk about the law of opposites as a universal law. And so I came to the realization, if there's a law that says we fall down, there must be something that says there's a law that we fall up. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found that law. It's called the grace of God. And through the grace of God, I have fallen up. And I've seen other people who don't fall down anymore. In life situations, we fall up. And the book talks about that also very clearly. It says, you'll develop a spiritual liberation and a spiritual release from the problems of the world. It doesn't say you won't have them, you'll just see them entirely differently. In fact, most offenses will go unnoticed because you'll be so busy living life. It seems as though most of the folks who get in trouble have no life, so the problems become everything. If you're too busy living life, those problems become insignificant. I don't know about the hereditary part of this disease. In fact, I know very little. As I stay here longer, I'm getting close to knowing absolutely nothing. I can almost touch it, you know? People say, what do you know? Nothing. It's amazing how it keeps the conversation very brief. And you don't have people calling you with complex problems because they know you're going to tell them, hey, I don't know anything about that. All I know is that you go to meetings, you work with other people, you grow spiritually, and you allow God into your life to do those things that you're not capable of doing for yourself. And then it gets real, real easy. But as I said, as I stay here longer, I know less and less. And that's a real comfortable feeling. And I watch the folks who want to get a lot of knowledge. And in this book, too, Dr. Silkworth, in The Doctor's Opinion, talks about that. He says, most of what's important in Alcoholics Anonymous lies outside the professional area. He said, because professionals just have synthetic knowledge. If you look up the word synthetic, which I had to do, it means not real. Their knowledge is all secondhand, what somebody else said. But alcoholics have a distinct advantage when working with one another because we have our own experience, and we can share that experience. And that's why I like reading that chapter, Working with Others. When people are confused, they say, I don't know what to do with this guy. I say, why don't you read that chapter, Working with Others? It's amazing. They have whole chapters in this book about stuff we need to know. Well, how does it work? Oh, I don't know. Maybe there's something in here about that. You know? I'm having trouble with my family. Oh, let's see if we can find that. I don't believe in God. Oh, yeah, let's try that. Yeah. I think if you don't believe in God when you get here, you're in a better shape than most people who do believe in God. That's just my experience. There's a lot of paradoxes in AA, and one of the big paradoxes is people who believe in God as a loving God and the brotherhood of man kill each other. When's the last time you heard of an agnostic beating up an atheist? You know? This doesn't happen. That's a paradox. I don't hear of any atheists invading Lebanon. You know, like, hey, we're taking over for the atheists. No. There's a lot of paradoxes here. Things that look this way turn out to be that way. And alcoholics have that great capacity, and I had it too, to add two and two and get five. You know, they tell the story of the alcoholic who was sitting on the plane and he's drinking. And the pilot didn't know it, but he left his microphone on. And he said, you know, he said, the last several days have been so stressful. What I need is a good stiff drink and some sex. And with that, the stewardess started running to the cabin to let him know the microphone was on. And the drunk yelled out, don't forget his drink! You know? I don't know if I mentioned it because I forget a lot of stuff that I say. But when you are laughing, you know, one of the things I spend some time studying is laughter. And when you are laughing, the one thing you cannot do along with laughing is think. You cannot think and laugh at the same time. So every time you laugh, you get a respite from your favorite topic, which is you. You know? If we had a theme song in AA, it would be, I am always on my mind. The other thing I know about laughter that most people don't know, and medical people can tell you this, is it's very healthy for you. They now know that when you're laughing a lot, it releases endorphins into the system. And endorphins help you fight pain, it gives you more oxygen, just as good stuff for you. In fact, they list laughing now as far as health-wise, right up with sex and jogging. So if you have a mate who likes aerobics, you can tickle, you know, you're in good shape. You guys have, what are you doing? We're on a health kick. But in 1983, I went to volunteering in the hospice program, working with people who were terminally ill. And I didn't know at the time why I did that. It's just something that came about. But it was one of the most worthwhile experiences. I still do it today. It's been one of the most worthwhile experiences for me. As I mentioned before, my God likes to do bang shots just to show off. So I thought I was going there to get like a new area of interest. And the very first guy I was sent out to see turned out to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was sober 39 years. And over the last, since 83, over the last 9 years, everyone I've worked with in the hospice program has been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that wasn't the way it started out to be, it's just that's the way God had it worked out. And the reality of working with people when they only have a short time to live is the fact you see how important each day becomes. You know, the book talks about God doesn't make our misery, we make our misery. And a lot of folks have trouble accepting that. They really do. They just have trouble with it. And yet, I could tell you this factually from my own experience, but you wouldn't know until you experience it. But if any one of us were to go home tonight and get a sheet of paper and write down what we feel are the most important things in our life, problems, good points, etc., and we were to put it on a piece of legal paper, and tomorrow or the next day we were to get a health report saying we only had 2 or 3 months to live, we would take that piece of paper and set it aside, and we would make up a whole new life. And what Alcoholics Anonymous is it's making up the second list first. It's deciding what's really important and where you want to spend your time. It's about deciding where you want to focus your day. It's about where do you want to put your energy. Do you really think what you're doing now is what God wants you to do? Not about, hey, I'm successful in what I'm doing. It's, are you really doing what you think God wants you to do? And everybody has to answer that for themselves, and thank God we can, in whatever terminology we have. And it's not about getting confused, it's about getting real simplistic. That's why I like hanging out with the guys I hang out with, because they don't have those complicated things. And they used to call me on the phone, and I still get a lot of guys that call me who are going through stuff, and they're, you know, their wives would laugh. Ken, he left. Ken, I lost my job. And I said, come on over. And I used to take them down to see these guys who were dying. And I remember guys would call me up, and I would take them down to see Stanley. And Stanley had a catheter in him, and he had a colostomy, and he was on all these tubes, and he just looked terrible. And I'd go in there, and I'd bring this bozo in with me who told me he had all these problems, and I'd say, Stanley, this bozo's having problems with the program today. And Stanley would take off his oxygen mask. He'd say, wow, are we lucky to be sober and Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California? Is God beautiful or what? And he'd go on until he ran out of oxygen. Then he'd put the mask back on and go back to breathing. And we'd visit him for a while. And the end result of that was when we got out in the hall later, we'd talk, and I'd say, now tell me about your problems. And you see, we just don't have a big enough perspective in most cases to put our problems in. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my perception of life was very, very narrow. And what AA has been for me is a fade-out shot. It's allowed me to back further and further and further up. And as I do, I get more and more of the panorama of life. And I realize there's so much more that was always going on that I could never see because I was focused on what was so small. My life was very insignificant. And now today my life is insignificant, but it's real exciting. And I learned that the door to the extraordinary is always marked ordinary. And when you become really appreciative of what's ordinary, you start living an extraordinary life. And it's all about being in the moment. And it's not about tomorrow, and it's not about yesterday. In fact, my own experience is that anything that takes me out of this moment is not worthwhile. The book says I become conscious of the presence of God, and I can only become conscious of the presence of God if I'm in the present too. And it says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. You can only find God in the present. And I don't want to waste time running around looking for other things. I want to stay focused on the great reality. And that's the great reality for me. And I have a peace in my life today that I've never experienced before. I don't owe anybody anything in terms of I have to go and make an amends tonight because I did something stupid today. I'm conscious of my actions most of the time. And today most of my faults really fall into the area of omission rather than commission. Things I should have done that I didn't do, not things that I did that I'm sorry I did. And the end result of that is that life gets real simple. And every time I think I'm getting so spiritual, I have kids to remind me of my reality. You know, I have a son who turned 32, and I called him on the phone, and I was very fatherly, and I said to him, you know, doesn't seem that long ago I was holding you in my arms, and you were wetting the bed. And he said, Dad, doesn't seem that long ago you were wetting the bed. You know? And that has a way of bringing you right back into the real world, you know. Thanks for sharing that, you know? And you get a dip. You don't have this intensity about spirituality. You have a laxness about it, you know? I don't feel real comfortable when I go to a meeting and I say, you know, is that chair saved? And they say, no, but we're working on it. You know, and that's not for me. You know? I like the kind of spirituality where you say, you know, the fish in the sea aren't thirsty. You know, it's a looseness about it. It's a looseness. And it comes very easy. I had a friend who's passed away, and he used to come to my house. He was from India, and he was from Bombay. And he would come into my house, and whenever he came into my house, he would put his hands together, and he would say, Namaste, Ken. And whenever he left, he would put his hands together, and he would say, Namaste, Ken. And if you don't know what that means, loosely translated, it means, the God in me recognizes the God in you. And as long as the God in me recognizes the God in you, although we may have differences on the surface about a lot of things, we'll never do any harm to one another. Because down deep we're all connected. One of the great truths of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll come to realize this at some point, hopefully, if you haven't already done so, is that we all swim in the same water here. And our job is not to contaminate the water we swim in. And we don't contaminate it by practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is a game where only losers can win, and the price of admission is your old ideas. And life gets real, real simple here. And there's absolutely nothing to figure out. There's absolutely no place to go. There's absolutely nothing to become. Everything we can ever be, we are right now. And you see, I didn't know that stuff. I just didn't know that stuff. And when Stanley was dying, I realized why I was there. I was there because at 1981, when I had gone through my divorce, for some reason I had lost the capacity to risk and trust again. And I had trouble loving. And what I learned as a result of that experience was, here was someone I could love, at least in this circumstance, because they weren't going to be around that long. But it opened up the gate. As the book says, it opens the door. And it opened the door where I could give myself wholly to another human being and not feel like it was I was going to get shortchanged in the deal somehow. And I learned a lot of lessons as a result of just being there and going through a daily procedure with another alcoholic. I also had the opportunity of watching him laying down do more than some people do standing up healthy and moving around. He was always there. He never said, hey, don't bring someone in. I'm not feeling good today. It would be, yeah, bring that bozo down here. Let's work on him, you know? And that's what he wanted to do. And when he was dying, the nurse who we had had some friction during the time because we were just on different pages. Some of it was my fault, obviously, but we were just on different pages. But when he went into coma and he was actually dying, it was an interesting occurrence because I would go there and I would read the big book to him. And she said, he's in a coma, he can't hear you. And I said, that's okay, I want to do this anyway. And the second day he was in that coma and I was reading and I was just overcome with all that he had done for me in this situation. And for some reason the pages got a little confusing to me and I was misty and so I skipped like you do when you're reading a kid's book and you just want to get them to go to bed and you just want to skip to the end. And I skipped. And a few minutes later, the last thing I heard him say was, you skipped. And he never opened his eyes. He just said, you skipped. And you know, my whole focus in my life from that point on has been not to skip. You know, whenever anyone anywhere reaches out, just go and do the deal and not try to project what's going to happen and not tell anybody else what to do. But really just say, hey, you know, this is what we did. And it's worked. And it's worked for countless others. And whenever I get confused about how to sponsor, I myself go back and I reread that chapter working with others. And there's three nevers in there that are real important that a lot of people don't realize. The first never is, we never criticize another alcoholic. Never. I don't know what part of that word causes a problem, whether it's the ner or the verb, but it's never. And the second never in there says we never force ourselves on another alcoholic. Never. Because then we may lose the opportunity to be of help later on. And the third never, which I love, is it says we never speak down to another alcoholic as though we're on some spiritual or moral hilltop. Never. Our job is just to be there and offer the spiritual tools that have been laid at our feet to other people. And then it's their job to decide whether or not this is what they want. And if they don't want it, that's okay. That's their business. They have that right. And the book talks about that. And you know, it gets real simple. I'm always reminded of the fact that the starting date for Alcoholics Anonymous is not the date that Bill Wilson got sober, but the date that Bill Wilson carried the message to Bob. That's the starting date of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't that Bill Wilson was sober, it was when he carried the message to another alcoholic. That's the official starting date of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's something that took me a while to grasp, those kind of simplicities, that this is all about carrying the message. Here in California, as you know, when we get on the highway now in the LA area, we have a special lane, the Diamond Lane. And you get to use that lane if you have a passenger. So the deal is the state is getting onto the sharing too. You know? It's like, you take somebody with you, we put you in a special lane. You know, it doesn't mean you're special. You just get to use this special lane. And that's what AA has become for me. It's the Diamond Lane. You know, you get to share with other people. You get to say, hey, you know, come on, come with me. Where are you going? I really don't know. What are we going to do when we get there? I have no idea. Then why should I go with you? Because I'm happy, I'm joyous and free, and I'm sober. And I'm trying to learn more and more about what I don't know, just like you are. So come on with me and we'll share that ignorance. You know? It's not about telling them what to do. And not about skipping. And then life gets real simple. The friend who used to come to my house, Harish, and tell me namaste, went back to drinking. Couldn't stay sober. And he ended up in a mental institution. And as a result of being there, he was reintroduced to drugs, which were a downfall for him. and he came home on a weekend pass, and rather than live the life he was living, he took his life. And he was probably the most gentle human being I've ever known. And here he couldn't hurt or wouldn't hurt anyone else, but he didn't want to live the way he was living, so he took his own life. And I always remember him as that little guy who would come to the door and stand there so politely and say, "Namaste." And you know, this whole recovery process for me today, right now, is I'm real, real happy to be here with you guys in Auburn. And I'm real glad that Charlie picked me up. And I'm glad that he and Irene brought me over here. And I'm glad to be part of your deal, whatever your deal is. I'm real happy to be alive. I'm real happy to be in the game. And if I get nothing else out of it, this is enough. Nobody owes me anything. I'm not volunteering, but if my ticket gets punched tonight, nobody owes me anything. I've had the best 22 plus years that any human being could have. I have kids that have grown up healthy, and I've been a part of that. I went through a divorce, and I got to be a single parent. My kids stayed with me, you know, and that was an interesting thing. Because they helped me, you know, I told them, "You can't leave home till I'm grown." You know, like, and they were very loving and kind, and they did the best they could, and eventually they had to go. You know, they couldn't wait forever. But I have a granddaughter now, and that's a whole deal. You know, and they live up in Seattle. When I was up there to see them a couple of weeks ago, we got a chance to go over to by the Needle, and there's now a park there with a roller coaster. And she says, "Grandpa, let's go on the roller coaster." And I said, "No, honey." I said, it goes too fast, and it's too big, and the hills are too steep." And she says, "Papa, I'll hold your hand." And you know, kids are just terrific, because you can't get a kid out of the moment. They don't know diddle squat about tomorrow. You even say later, it's like, "Is later now?" They don't know. "Is later now?" You know, like, "Are we going to do it now?" And you get to watch kids, and they have these great answers for life. You know, you watch a kid collecting seashells on the beach, and it's like you would think they were collecting gold or diamonds. They're all excited about that. They're excited about little things. You know, you get a chance to watch them, and I don't know what happens, but you get a chance to watch them down at the beach. When you guys hopefully come down for the 95 convention, it's going to be held in San Diego. And the hotel it's going to be at, the Marriott there, is in Seaport Village. And you'll get to see these kids play. And you know, they push each other. And like, Johnny will go to kiss Mary, and she'll push him in the water. And he'll bounce right up. And you know, he doesn't feel worthless. You know? And he doesn't call his sponsor. There are no phones at the beach, you know? He just goes and kisses Susie, and, you know, and he keeps swapping spit with someone until it catches on, you know, and then it's like, whoa, and kids are just like that. There was a kid flying a kite down there several years back, and there was low clouds, and his kite was above the clouds, and as I walked by him, I love to talk to kids, they're the most intelligent people I know. I said to him, "How do you know your kite's still there?" And he looked at me and he said, "Because I can feel the pull of it, mister." And you see, that's the way AA has been for me. When I'm doing God's work, I feel the pull of it. I can't see it, but I feel the pull of it. And when I'm not doing His work, I feel that the pull of that too. And I like the first pull a lot better. And in life, you get to find out it's not about seeing things, it's just knowing they're there. And you get to live life real, real simple. And no matter what happens, it's okay. Somebody recently sent me a card, and it was a Chinese card. And the Chinese write in ideograms, which are like pictures. And on the back of this card was the word crisis. And in the Chinese language, it's made up of two ideograms. One is danger, and the other is opportunity. And that all crises are full of danger and opportunity. A danger to my way of life, but an opportunity to grow spiritually. And you know, since I learned that everything that happens to me, no matter how I perceive it, is really a spiritual problem, life has gotten real, real simple. I'm glad you guys have tolerated me this long. I'm real glad you invited me up here. And I would just say with you, to you very slowly and carefully, we have to take real good care of one another because we're always on loan. And you just never know when you're going to say goodnight to somebody and put off saying you love them, thinking you'll see them tomorrow, and that tomorrow doesn't come. So say you love them now. Be good to them now. Don't put off anything. In 1985, I went back home in October. And as I said, I don't know anything about the hereditary part of this disease, but my family, we seem to be divided into two groups. Either you're in AA or you need it. And nobody in my family has made it. And I went home, and it was my sister's brother, my sister's birthday, and my mother's birthday, and my brother's birthday. And my sister turned 54. And I came back to California, and a week later she went in the hospital with cirrhosis. And she bled and hemorrhaged until Christmas Day of 85, and she died weighing about 60 pounds. And we buried her. And a week later, New Year's Day, my brother died. And my mom, who didn't realize that kids could die first, died a few months later, and Stanley died. And over the next 18 months, I went to the cemetery 11 times. And the thing that came out of that was the fact that every headstone in the cemetery looks exactly alike. It has when you were born. First it has your name, then it has when you were born, and then it has a dash and when you died. And that dash on any cemetery headstone is no more than 6 to 8 inches. And that dash is life. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm along in the dash. And I don't want to waste one day being resentful. And I don't want to waste one day trying to figure it out. I just want to live it. And I want to allow everybody around me to live it too. And I want to encourage them to live it, because I know this is what it's all about, living life one day at a time. So God bless you. Take real good care of one another. I love you. Namaste.